Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome once again to another edition of
Dispatches,
based on a lifetime after lifetime after lifetime after lifetime of service to Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. It is my great pleasure tonight to interview from Calapa, Halifax, Nova Scotia, Carolyn Gimion. I think Carolyn and her husband, Jim, probably have clocked in more service hours together than many of us. They could be flying some kind of jumbo jet of service to Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. So I am completely delighted and honored to be speaking with Carolyn this evening and bringing her comments on her lifetime of service to Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche in the past, in the present, and in the future. Welcome, Carolyn.
Thank you, Julia. It's really delightful to be here in Calapa, in your attic, in the wonderful studio that you have for this. Yeah.
Yeah, one of the things that I like about this attic in a day like today is I look out the window and it's gray, rainy, and cold, even though it's supposed to be spring. So yeah. It's a very Chogyam Trungpa weather.
Yeah.
As you know, the way that we structure this show is that we pretty much have two parts to it. In the first one, we want to know a little bit about the nature of people's relationship with Trungpa Rinpoche, and then in the second part, we talk a little bit about how that relationship, that kind of continuity of service, is being expressed these days, the commitment to his vision.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't we begin, and you can tell me a little bit about, even though we could probably spend days talking to you about the nature of your relationship with Trungpa Rinpoche.
Well, gee, that's such a big topic. I was living in my hometown of Boulder, Colorado in 1970-71 when Chogyam Trungpa came there. And so I thought for a long time that I was really lucky that I was born in Boulder and this man came after I became a student of his, until I realized that there were very, very few natives of Boulder, Colorado who became his students. So I'm not always sure that, I mean, most of the natives didn't seem to jump at the opportunity to study with him. It was mainly people who moved there. But I met him in 1970, and I kind of couldn't relate to him because he came to my hometown, and I thought that only a very insignificant guru would come to my hometown, whatever hometown that was. You know, it wasn't so. Then when I moved to California, I was able to connect with him, and I realized that he was part of a much bigger world. And I suppose I'm still discovering that. In my life, a lot of it has been discovering that he was a much bigger person, and both in terms of my practice and my work and talking with other people. Because somewhat part of what my work has been over the years is, in an informal way, doing sort of what you're doing, trying to connect with people and find out what treasures they have, what things they might contribute to his legacy, and how to help ensure that that happens. And I'm always amazed at discovering yet another phase of him, or yet another world that he was part of, or will be part of, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Because a lot of the work you did was working on the archives and working on editing his works and so on. What kinds of things can you tell us that you've been actually doing?
I started editing books and other materials of his in the 70s, and that was the focus of the work that I did during his lifetime. Before he died, I started getting interested in the idea of having an archives of his work. But after his death, then that became much more the focus for me, of trying to be sure that all of the... He gave, you know, several thousand talks in English, in North America, beginning in 1970. And amazingly enough, we have almost all of those on tape, which is really quite extraordinary. If he had taught 20 years before, we wouldn't have had that. It's the first generation that could actually keep really the actual voice of a teacher alive, you know, potentially for hundreds of years. And additionally, he wrote hundreds of poems. He took photographs. People took thousands of photographs of him. Obviously, the project that you're connected with in this radio show, like the Chronicles, Walter is very much involved with collecting oral histories. So I got involved with all of those things in terms of the Shambhala archives.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
trying to ensure that materials would be saved, videotapes, all that stuff.
Excellent. One of the parts of your life that people are probably not aware of is that you have been involved in radio shows in Spanish.
Yes, one that I can think of.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about
that? You want to hear that
about
story?
Your radio show?
Oh, well, in 1979, right after Jim Gimian and I got married, we went to Mexico with Chigam Trumpa and a group of people, and included in that party were Ursel Tenzin, the Vajra regent, Ron Barnstone, who is from Mexico, and his mother, Marty Franco, had been very generous to Trumpa Rinpoche and his wife over the years, giving them places to stay and helping them in other ways if they wanted to travel to Mexico. And several other people went with us on that trip. And we went to the house of Roger and Louise Randolph, who were students of the Vidyadharas, very generous patrons, I guess you could say, donors to the Sangha. They had a beautiful little cottage, sort of house in Pátzcuaro with a walled garden, and Rinpoche loved to go there, and he went there a number of years. Anyway, we went on this trip, and it happened to be the year that the Pope was visiting Mexico for the first time in, I don't know how many years, century, I don't know how long it had been since Mexico had had a visit from the Pope. I think there was some church-state thing that had to be worked out. So we kept running across. When we were leaving Guadalajara to come back to the United States, we saw the Pope's airplane being guarded by Mexican police and stuff. So we got this idea that we wanted to do an interview with Trumpa Rinpoche as the Pope. And the regent and Jim and I were the main people who worked on this, Ron Barnstone also, but we kept writing these little riffs about, we had the part of it that we did, which was sort of stupid, and then we had the interview with Rinpoche, and finally the interview happened. I mean, we kept recording these little bits of, I don't know, as I was just saying, the name of our station was Radio Pa-H-A-T, Pat! We kept coming to you from different parts of Mexico, depending on where we were. And we wrote out scripts that we read in really bad Spanish, mostly. And Randolph's had a collection of really bad, not bad, it's terrible to say this. They had a collection of sort of folklore music that was to our ears anyway. It was funny. So we would say Radio Pa H-A-T, and then on would come this strange music that made us all laugh. And anyway, and we were talking to Rinpoche about how we wanted to do this, working on questions to ask him, and one night he wanted to go to the town of Morelia, which is near Pátzcuaro, I guess, and we drove there and we had dinner on a terrace overlooking the city, and Trumpa Rinpoche wanted to have a tequila drinking contest with the regent, and he insisted on that the regent match him shot for shot, and they drank a huge amount of tequila. And then Rinpoche said, let's drive back, and I want to do the radio show tonight. So we rehearsed this. I asked him a series of questions in Spanish and English, and I would say things like, Your Holiness, when you came to Mexico, why did you kiss the ground? Bad Spanish. And then I would say, whatever it would be. Su Santidad, ¿por qué besó la tierra cuando llegó a México? And he said, I thought I should do it to them before they did it to me. Things like that. So we have that recording somewhere. It was a spontaneous...
I think we should probably have a special...
Well, you could have a piece of it to play on your...
Yeah, we should definitely air it sometime. And, I have this joke that I like Nova Scotia so much that whenever I get here, I would kiss the ground, but my lips would stick to it. Because it's so cold. So going beyond your radio career in Spanish and talking about you've done the Chronicles and a lot of editing, you seem to be moving forward in a new phase of actually trying to capture the seed syllable, if that can even be said or done, of Trumpa Rinpoche. Do you want to share a little bit about...
I'm just contemplating that idea of capturing his seed syllable.
Yeah, if that's even possible.
I don't know. I think I'd explode, but...
Yeah. Well, actually, the question would be then, like, do you think in some ways, I mean, where do you get your inspiration? I mean, do you, actually, one of the things we were joking about this show, I remember the whole thing about, there was all these protests in college campuses about history being about dead white men, and we decided that this show was about dead brown men who rule your life. And, you know, in some way we all get our inspiration from somewhere. Yeah. Where do you get yours? How do you find it? Where is it?
Well, I think, like so many of Rinpoche's students, that I feel such a huge debt to him. I feel it will, you know, wouldn't be possible to repay for many lifetimes. So I feel like I was given an opportunity, and I don't really understand why I was given that opportunity. In other words, the fact that he invited me to become one of his editors and gave me that opportunity and gave me the opportunity to spend time around him and encouraged me to do that during periods of my life. Jim, my husband, has sometimes said that he thinks that maybe we have stuck with this aspect of service, you know, in some ways, partly because we have nothing better to do with our lives, and that a lot of other people who have a lot of talent and drive to do something else, accomplish something else, really... and so they have felt torn because they had to choose. But I never, mostly, have not felt that I had to make a choice. This seemed to be the way that I also, in this way that Rinpoche also, I think, was amazing with people, that he could find, he could tap your innate talent. You know, I'm sure we've all talked to people, we had these experiences ourselves where if you were a latent interior designer, he would talk to you about color and shape and things like that. And if you were destined to be a cook, even though you might be in law school, he would somehow get you in the kitchen, you know, making a roast lamb or something. And in my case, he picked up on the fact that I had this connection to the written word, and I don't really know why or how. I mean, maybe it was obvious, but wasn't to me entirely. So I felt that he just gave me this opportunity that was to be exactly what I really, really wanted to be and do in my life. Mm-hmm. And so it hasn't exactly felt like a sacrifice in that sense.
Yeah, and one of the things these days that as I get to know some other people who are editors, and it's interesting to talk to them, is sometimes you wonder if the written page has a lot to do with the editor versus having a lot to do with the author. But I imagine in this case, there would be no way to actually get in the way.
No, I think it would be really hard. I mean, what I've seen is, because I've listened to a lot of the talks on which books are based, you can mess it up a little bit. It's hard to improve him, but it is really hard to get in the way because the force of what he was saying and the force of the logic, too. Like before I became an editor working with him, I was working with Shambhala Publications, and I worked on a lot of other people's work. I couldn't believe how flawless Rinpoche's logic was. You know, it's very, very, very rare that you ever had to restructure anything that he taught because of problems with logic. I mean, if you wanted to combine two or three things, you might do it, or he might occasionally forget if there were six paramitas, he might leave one out. But when he was going through ground, path, and fruition, it was always, you know, it was just right there. So it was like studying. You could learn a lot from just paying attention to how he talked about things.
Mm-hmm. One of the probably things that Walter had brought out at some point is that probably every single one of us is a bit of a relic in some way.
That he kind more of, so all the time.
Yeah, fossilized relic. You know, shrinking over. Yeah. Pretty soon it'll be Jurassic Sangha. And that there's almost like his parts of his essence were sort of poured into us in different ways, and yours has a lot to do with coming through with language. These days, do you reread his talks? Do you look at his picture? It's interesting because my relationship to him was never necessarily a written word relationship. Uh-huh. So I have a probably when I feel like I need a hit I look at his picture and have a sense of inspiration, have a sense of connecting to whatever kindness he paid to me. How do you get inspired? Do you look at pictures? Do you practice? Do you...
Is there an all of the above?
Yes. Do you read? Do you go for walks?
Yeah. Well, I find that I do a lot of editorial work to the extent that I'm still working on books, which I still am. I like to do that work in sort of semi-retreat, so I like to mix the actual editing of his talks with practice. And I find that the practice obviously is a very powerful environment for connecting with him. I mean, I find if I practice for a couple of days, at a certain point I start to feel almost like he's there in the atmosphere or something, or I feel him. And I also do find that reading what he said is powerful, and I find videotapes and audio tapes of his lectures, if you have the time and the space to slow down and actually get into it, are very, very powerful.
The videotapes?
Yeah, they're really powerful. And different things. Poetry, I didn't connect with so much during his lifetime, actually, but now I find that that's a particularly interesting voice at times. It's kind of revealing. And
Yeah. Slowing down. Slowing down. That's probably going to be the kind of the curse of the modern life, but the blessing of the aging, that we'll be able to slow down. So maybe we should be grateful that we're falling apart, because we can run as fast as we used to, and maybe we'll actually slow down enough to hear him again.
Yeah. The other thing I find is that there is this richness to, as irritating as the Sangha is, I mean, I find the Sangha very irritating. Don't you all? But at the same time, I find Rinpoche reflected all over the place in the people that he knew, and sometimes in people that he didn't know, you know. And I think if you teach, as you, as many of us have done, you find this all the time, that you meet people who seem to have made this connection. You definitely have made a connection to him. And sometimes it might be more profound than my connection in certain areas, because they're not actually troubled by... In a certain way, having known him, there's that aspect of it which is very profound, but it can also be an obstacle to actually seeing a broader view of who he was, or, you know, and so I find him reflected all over the place.
In terms of the continuity of your work these days, you have been working on a project. You tell me that the working title is the Chogyam Trungpa Foundation and Institute.
Just trips merrily off the tongue.
Because of the Bawa Wawa version of the show.
About that. Well, the idea of this is to have one place that in perpetuity is dedicated to preserving and propagating the Vidyadharas, and helping people who are doing that to preserve and propagate his teachings. And I have a couple of images that I've been working with, one of which is a presidential library, which is makes sense to people from the United States more than from other parts of the world. Every president, every administration, after the presidency is done, Congress passes an act and there is a library established for that president. And generally it's funded by people who had a connection with that person and what he stood for. So far it's all been he's, so we can say he. And it's not in opposition to what's happening in the current government, but government moves on, right? But you still need a place that focuses on the mandate of a particular administration, or that's, I think, how they would say it. And I got inspired by going to the John F. Kennedy Library and Archives in Boston. I met the archivist who was a sound and moving image archivist for that institution, and he graciously invited me to visit if I was in Boston, so I went there and I toured. And in addition to having Kennedy's archives, they have a huge oral history project there, like thousands of hours of interviews that they did. In addition to that, they had a Hemingway room, because he had this connection with Ernest Hemingway, so they had a Hemingway collection. So it was things connected to his life, as well as just him, you know, his administration and life. And then they also had a museum where they had all of the things that belonged to Kennedy, and they created exhibits so you could go through and learn about his life and its significance and the work that he was doing in so many different areas. And one of the really powerful places there was his desk, and there was his office. They had recreated his office, and they had an audio recording of him and his brother when his brother was the attorney general, when they were integrating a school in the South. And they were on the phone that day with, I don't know, the police and the governor. I don't know which, I forget, you know.
Alabama.
Could have been Alabama. And they were fighting, you know, they were basically trying to figure out their strategy and their tactics. And as you listened to that, as you walked around in the room, you saw the space in which all this was taking place, and they had all the things out on his desk, and they had the photographs on the walls, and it was very powerful. And I realized we had all these things that Rinpoche had left from his life, and he had said, please take care of all these things and do something with them. They're not just casual. You know, all the collections that I've made in my life, things I've brought together, are not casual. And I thought, wow, you know, this would be incredibly powerful if we could do something like this. The other thing that happened was I went back to the Kennedy Library, and many years after he died, during the Clinton administration, they completely redid most of the exhibits, because when they did the exhibits right after he died, they were all based on this tremendous tragic sense of loss and love. And so they were very personal, and they spoke to people who knew Kennedy and who went through the tragedy of his death, which was so powerful for many, many people in the world. But then they realized years later that it didn't speak to people anymore that way. So they changed the exhibit so that they told the story of that period of time. And they were less focused on Kennedy, the man, and more on what he stood for in the era and the culture out of which he came. But they still kept the desk, because that was just, that particular exhibit was such a powerful evocation. Now, I haven't been to any other presidential libraries, but that really stuck with me. And gave me pause about what we might be able to do.
Did they have his rocking chair too?
Yeah, they did, actually. They had the rocking chair somewhere. I don't remember exactly, but yeah, they did. All kinds of stuff.
And how is this project different from the archives, for example?
Well, the archives has, you know, it's part of an ongoing... it started with its primary mandate being the Vidyatara, being Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche and his life. But it's now grown to encompass the teachings of many other teachers, and it will be an ongoing institution that needs to take care of the teachings of the Sakyong Mipham Rinpoche. We have teachings by Kenpo Tsultrum Gyamso, lots of them, other people, and that's going to continue. And so while the archives has to be able to also... It's involved in recording. It works with Kalpa recordings to be sure that what's happening at this moment in time is being taken care of, properly recorded. It's responsible for all of the institutional records of Shambhala. And so, meaning if the board of directors has meetings, those should go into the Shambhala archives. Whereas this institution, I don't think it would replace, there would be a Shambhala archives, but the Chögyam Trungpa Foundation and Institute would first of all help to fund the activities of the archives that relate to Chögyam Trungpa, and it might also help to provide situations that are focused specifically on the Vidyatara and his teachings, and provide a place in which people could continue to practice teachings that he gave in the context in which he gave them. So, for example, you could go and study... I don't know whether it would always... It doesn't necessarily have to be a place. I mean, this is one of the things that I think we... That's the problem with that visualization of the presidential library. There might be such a place. But I'm thinking initially more that there could be activities sponsored by this institution if it takes off. In Boulder, in New York, there could be some in Europe. So, for example, we have a program called Shambhala Art now, which incorporates a lot of teachings that came from Chögyam Trungpa, but it also incorporates other things. And the way in which that material is presented is quite different than it would have been during his lifetime. I think there's a real value in not just archiving, but actually continuing to practice the disciplines that he gave us in the way that he gave them to us, in the same way that we practice, say, the Vajrayogini sadhana, a Vajrayogini sadhana that's been passed down for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And there's a power in tradition. And So this would be speaking to and trying to encourage that.
Interesting. It's almost like trying to capture what he was doing in specific and in the context also, the actual practices, the actual style, the particular formats, the particular context, the structures. Interesting.
And, well, I just don't mean to just blah, 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 but I guess I'm here to blah, 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 right?
Okay. We're here. That's why we invite you.
The other image that I have been thinking of with this is like a liberal arts college, meaning a place that has a dedication to a vision, but in which people, if you think about colleges or universities, people can be fiercely loyal to their institution, but they can also really not get along with one another. And one of the things about the Vidyadhara that was so wonderful is that he was able to bring together this diverse group of people who didn't necessarily get along or agree, you know, but they were held together under the umbrella of his teachings and his vision. And I think we need that kind of an influence, wouldn't be a bad influence on our world, for to be able to bring together people who may have very, very different ideas about who he was or how his teachings should be viewed, but who nevertheless share this sense of commitment and passion to that. And I just finally want to say that it's not going to be what I want. That what I really am hoping is that I'm just trying to put out, also with the support of some other people, this idea to see what it is, if anything, that the Sangha wants and how we could build something together.
How far along are you in the project in terms of gathering people, talking about it, writing it, gathering funds?
Nowhere, no.
So this is it?
I mean, I've been talking with Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche's widow, Diana Mokpo. I've been working with her for a number of years now on various projects, and one of which is her memoirs, which are coming out in October of 2006. And she's very interested in helping to support a project champion, a project like this. So I have been talking with her. I spent some time talking with Richard Ryok, the president of Shambhala International, and he's very interested and supportive of something like this. So I've done a little bit of sort of trying to lay the ground. But the stage we're at right now is just to try and let people know that something like this might be in the works. And then hopefully between now and the 20th anniversary of the Vidyadhara's death, we would like to have some kind of consultations, a year of consultation with people to find out, because there are a lot of institutions, like you're not, you know, you're saying, how does this relate to the Shambhala archives? Well, other people would say, how does this relate to Naropa? They teach a lot of what the Vidyadhara taught. How does this relate to Shambhala training? How does this relate to the Chronicles? How does this relate to the Nalanda Translation Committee? Why do we need this? Do we need this? You know, some people would say, no, it's just redundant. Other people would say, we absolutely need it. You know, people have very differing views. So I'd like to try and find out what people are thinking, and then out of that, come up with a board, a mandate, and also obviously funding. Funding is really key. So we're looking for patrons.
Okay, everybody hear that? Looking for patrons. Operators are waiting.
Right, yeah.
What are the Vidyadhara's relics right now? Would you consider doing a relic tour of some kind?
You mean the... what do you mean by relics?
Well, various kinds. There's pieces. I think the piece of the skull or a piece of the hip. And I think there's... also, remember, we used to have in the Karmazon building in Halifax, we used to every once in a while have a showing of some of his uniforms.
Yeah. Well, there are a few things happening with that. Jean Reardon Perks has taken... She's sort of the mistress of that... of those things, which we sometimes call the VCTR collection. And those things are stored in the basement of Shambhala International, the Shambhala Center in Halifax. And one thing we need to do is organize all that material. We need to catalog it. We need to be sure it doesn't get mildew. There's, you know, just that kind of level of care. There is an idea, and we've been talking about this for quite a long time, and some people actually have given funds for it, to install the Sirmong relics in the shrine room in Halifax. And the Sirmong relics are very, very precious and very few items that the Vidyadhara carried out of Tibet with him, which were small enough, I guess, that they fit on in a pack as they were traveling for 10 months out of from Sermong. And they include, I'm really bad with, I know I can say they're really, really precious, but then I should be able to list them off. But for example, there is a very small rupa carving in some kind of stone of Padmasambhava, which is supposed to change with the waxing and waning of the moon. It gets more red or more yellow, depending on the time of month. And it was carved by one of his 25 direct disciples. That's one thing we have. And that's stashed away in the Shambhala archives because it's so fragile that when you even lift it, the relics, the body relics that are probably Padmasambhava's body relics can fall out. They have a couple times fallen out of the rupa. Teeny little thing about 2 inches high. So we need do we need to build a special case for that, those things? And we need to build a big case. We need to build little cases that hold each one of those things individually, then the bigger case that they go into. We were talking about having an air conditioner that would run in that case that would keep them dry and cool. And so we're talking about that. So that's one small project. But there's also, for example, there's a piece of Naropa's skull with an incredible Haruka painted in the skull. But I think there is a huge future in for all these things, you know, of his. They're really extraordinary things that he had in his life. Some things like the relics, I mean, these Sermong relics are obvious. They're hundreds of years old, but things that he collected during his own lifetime that are quite beautiful and meaningful. And he used them in Dharma art installations. You know, he would take things that came from his home and create a room like the kitchen or the study and actually put into that in that room things that belonged to him as well as other things, and then do a beautiful flower arrangement with next to them. So I don't know, maybe we could get back into doing some of that as practice. And that, I think, is the kind of thing that the Chögyam Trungpa Foundation and Institute, plug, should, if we were a proper foundation with an endowment. I would love to have a situation where there was a board of directors that had money that they could give as grants to people wherever they are in the world, connected with whatever institution or on their own, whatever they're doing to promote the use and understanding of his teachings. I think it would be great to help support that.
So would you then also need to find people that understood certain parts of his teachings,
yeah,
like, for example, installations?
Sure.
Or ikebanas, or different kinds of calligraphies and so on, or poetry, and try to see if you can create almost environmental.
Yeah. Well, see, one thing is also, we have lots of, the question is, what happens as we become fossilized and we get older? Are we passing this down? There's the issue of actually preserving objects, and then there's the issue of passing on what we know. And in a greater sense, you know, in a broad sense, I think, yes, probably we are to some extent. But then there are these really specific but important things that people know. Say, what Ludwig Terzansky knows about how to do a flower arrangement, or what he worked on with the explorers of the phenomenal world and the other people who worked on that project. I don't even know if the listeners here would know what that is, but that was working with the Vidyadhara and you know, learning how to interact with the natural world in order to build these terrific installations. I don't have that knowledge, but I hope it's more than knowledge. I think it's a kind of wisdom that needs to be passed on. So people like that need to actually be practicing, at least a few, you know, some of them, because when they're gone, I don't know then.
You know, will pass.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. Just the other day, I got an email from Rachel Farrow, and she's in Miami, and she had actually invited Jack Nyland.
Mm-hmm.
To do some talks, I believe I'm correct, about related to Dharma art.
Yeah,
and I went, boy, would that be fun.
He and Robin Kornman just did something in New York.
Uh-huh.
And it sounded like, yeah, I think Jack's on the move.
Jack's on the move.
Yeah.
Good for Jack. He's following the Rolling Stones, actually.
Yeah.
That's what we don't know, but that's what he's actually doing. Do
yeah.
you have a cadre of committed people that are working on this project already?
I think there are a lot of people interested. I wouldn't say that there's yet, I don't think we've yet, it hasn't really yet gelled into what the group is going to be. I think there are 40 or 50 people I could think of, but who haven't really committed themselves to a position or, you know, what it is exactly that they want to do in different places. Yeah. Yeah. And Naropa is going to have a conference starting this October, probably every year, on Chögyam Trungpa, his life and teachings. And I think that's the beginning of the kind of thing that will happen over time. I mean, I sort of see him as a figure. I don't know where you'd place him because he was such a big cultural figure and religious figure, but, you know, in so many different areas. But like Shakespeare, you know, he became only more and better known after he died. Millions of people go to his plays. You know, there are the people who want to recite his sonnets. There are the people who want to act in his plays, the people who go to the plays, and the people who, you know, study what it was all about, what were the Oedipal aspects of Hamlet, whatever. So I have a feeling that that's my guess, anyway. That's where I'd put my money.
Well, it's very impressive what you're trying to do, and I definitely do hope that you can actually make this happen, because it almost feels like creating a multi-dimensional picture of... at one point, when Walter was talking about Trungpa Rinpoche saying that he wanted to make sure that people knew how we lived.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some ways, it's a statement. Yeah.
Yeah, it's how we lived and how he lived and how altogether we made a certain kind of world that was soaked and very contextually rich. And I think that's what you're talking about.
Yeah.
It's almost like recreating the sight, the sound, the smell, the taste, the touch. Of course, there'll be a museum that's only open from 3 in the morning till 7. And once you go in, you can't get out.
All right. The food is always cold.
The food is always cold. Yeah. You know, the exhibits will be like the unending tequila bar, you know. This is kind of an odd question, but I have asked myself that question too, is I find interesting that he died around 1987, and sometimes think that if had he been alive in the 90s, he would have been crucified.
Yeah.
And there was something about the kind of, for all of us, of course, it was way too soon.
Yeah.
And we never believed that it was possible. But, you know, did you ever sort of ponder about the time of his death vis-a-vis the cultural changes in the 90s? And because in some ways you're talking about bringing back something. And it's been 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's taken that long. Probably for us, A, to be able to reflect upon it enough to be able to do it or see the meaning of it. But do you ever think about that, the time of his death and the kind of...
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to be too theistic about it, but I think that Rinpoche was such an intentional person and he understood things so deeply. You know, he could sort of... When you talk about him seeing into the future, you could say it was prophetic. I mean, he had that quality of being someone who discovered Terma, which is definitely someone who's able to pull something out of the atmosphere at the right time. But at the same time, it's also that he just had so much prajna, so much interest in the world that he could follow the implications of an act now. It's like, you know, the beating of the butterfly's wings that could cause the hurricane across the world. He could follow that and he sort of could see those things in advance. So at times I think that, yeah, his death was certainly not a random. It was fairly probably deliberate timing in some ways. And yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of the things that we might think are deficits, so to speak, in his personal life. I mean, I find it very interesting that a lot of what's said about him in the popular whatever, wherever you'd read this, like if you read, as I sometimes do, reviews, people who review his books on Amazon.com, readers, a lot of people say, well, his teachings were amazing, but his life was terrible, and he did these awful things. He drank, and he had girlfriends, and, you know, whatever it was that bothered them. But I actually think that in the long run, that kind of scandalous aspect of him will be a great strength, both because it's like a beacon. It's very interesting. You know, you can't ignore it. You know, it's like, what is this about? And he was so, there's so many wonderful stories about him that rely on his unconventionality. But also because he was really willing to engage the West in a way that I don't think anybody yet has done. In that way, he was way ahead of his time. And I think that we have a kind of, right now anyway, a schism between public and private morality. I mean, our culture is so sexualized, and, you know, it's not as though we're all living these incredibly cloistered, semi-monastic, you know, desexualized lives or something. I mean, if you look at the media, it's amazing, yet we're so judgmental, you know.
So people only have sex with their computers and their televisions.
Yeah, I guess.
In private.
Right,
but
right.
You can't do it with anybody.
No, right.
That's really bad.
Yeah.
You can go to war. Though.
Yeah,
you
right.
You can kill people personally.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So I think that, you know, Rinpoche was like a symbol of sort of, I mean, he, you know, he just didn't shy away from any of that stuff. I think the reality is that we still like our religious or spiritual figures to be holy in a certain way, but in a way that's because it's not threatening and it doesn't actually touch this whole area of our lives, you know. That it's like how, if you're Catholic, how you relate to the priest. And the priest knows what goes on at home, and at home you know what you're supposed to do in the church. And people get along just fine, you know, but there's this kind of division. And he just didn't stand for that, you know. He was in the bedroom, in the bathroom, in the kitchen, in the living room with you.
Yeah, it makes me reflect upon the coincidence of the life of the Mahasiddhas, that they actually pretty much came to light at the time in which Buddhism in India was being threatened, destroyed by the Mughals. Yeah. And that was the time in which it was actually maintained by the Mahasiddhas, because they were, A, not killed because they weren't monks. That's my understanding. Of course, Larry Mermelstein will call in 5 minutes, 5 seconds, and tell me.
Oh, do we have a call in?
Larry would. Larry knows everything.
Yeah.
But my understanding is that they were very important in maintaining the real spirit, the kind of the reduction of the sauce of Buddha Dharma.
Yeah.
And actually, they transformed people's minds and people's lives.
I think also we know, because we kind of saw, you know, that also if you take monasticism really to the nth degree, and you take ordinary life to that degree, that they're both threatening to ego. They're both threatening to conventional, you know, reality. So, you know, and then there's everything in between.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
To actually to end the show, it's kind of a yet even odder question, but if you were to walk into Trungpa Rinpoche's bedroom, and he was there in the bed, and he, you know, was kind of had this sort of sleepy, sweet like milk with chili pepper kind of atmosphere. And it's who knows what time in the morning, who knows what time in the world.
Yeah.
What would you say to him?
Where have you been?
Okay. Well, thank you, Carolyn Dimion. And I hope that wherever he has been in all the exhibits that you're going to create and all the environments that you're going to create, and in all the recordings and all the relic exhibits. And we will have to have some kind of scratch and sniff sake taste exhibit too. So I hope that wherever he has been there for you and for all of us. So thank you very much for being with us today, and I wish you the absolute best, and definitely sign me up for the Foundation and Institute.
Great. Well, thank you for doing this, and yeah.
And muy buenas noches, nos despedimos de Radio PAHAT, Radio PAT. Thank you, Carolyn. Good night.
Thank you, Julia.
Thank you for listening to Dispatches. Please tune in again next week for Julia's conversation with Mindy Moore. Until then, this is Chronicles Radio wishing you a good evening.